Welcome to the 263rd episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Thank you for listening. So what is stiff? What is mobile? We've talked with Dr. Stuart McGill about having the spine being stiff and not hypermobile. I've talked about doing mobility exercises so that I become more mobile. You've heard of the yin and the yang, you give and the take. Yes, but yes, not. We're all right, we're all wrong. I could be speaking about running, I could be speaking about COVID, I could be speaking about my cooking, my bread making, a whole variety of things. If anything, in 2020, I think that I've come to understand or appreciate a little bit more is that maybe nothing is as it seems or nothing is as black and white. I've always been a fan of black or white. The gray things always confuse me. If it's a 90% blockage, if it's a 0% blockage, those 50 to 70% blockages in the cath lab are always, what do we do? You know, how do you make a decision medically on whether to treat somebody or not? If the risks are all one way or the benefits are all one way, it makes it a lot easier than if there are risks and benefits, and how do we interpret those? And among COVID, you know, that has been the big issue. Do we wear masks? Don't we wear masks? Do we isolate? Don't we isolate? Who do we protect? What do we close down? It's all new. Everybody, there's right in all of it. There's wrong in all of it. You know, the best view is going to be that from looking back in the future. Hopefully, we'll all be healthy when we look back into the future. And, you know, I think that this podcast, for me, has been a share of my passions. It started out as a share of plant-based education. I'm a runner, an endurance athlete. You know, I want to share my running. I'm not a professional runner. I didn't run in college. I went to medical school at West Virginia University and did my residency and fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh. I did a little stint in academic medicine, but I'm not a Nobel laureate. So, you know, I'm not the big science guy. I'm not in academia anymore. I'm in private practice. So, I've learned from observing. One of my favorite things, I think, in my life has been the observing of human behavior, both from a athletic perspective. Started out as golf when I was younger, and it's morphed into swimming and running and biking. And in medicine, it's been since I graduated from medical school in 1987, observing human behavior, both in response to disease and the body in response to disease and treatment. And, you know, the goal has been and still is and will forever be to try to decrease human suffering, including my own. And this podcast is about sharing how to, you know, make life a little bit better for everybody through, you know, in my opinion, plant-based nutrition, and in my opinion, endurance training. So I'll present some views on that and life experiences that I have both in my practice and in my life. And I hope you enjoy sharing those. You know, they're not all right. They're not all wrong. There are my opinion. Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, you know, talks about, you know, how we come up with the story of our life. We look at our past experiences and what we've learned in the past, our education, our living experience. And then when something happens, we then project a story of what we think the reality of it is into the future. And just by doing that, by projecting something into the future that hasn't necessarily happened, we can't ever be 100% sure. And I think that, you know, that causes a lot of unsettling for a lot of people, including myself. But I think if we just look at today, life might be just a little easier. And that's one thing that I would like to maybe share with you, is if we could look to what today is better than yesterday, what is a little bit better today, and what is the good that came out of today or the good that's coming out of today, and find some little good nugget that comes out of every day. And that's probably one of the biggest things that I've learned from my patients is just finding a little good in every day. And often it comes from the people that you would least expect it, the people that have the worst troubles when in my eye, you know, some of the worst things going on in their life seem to be the one that finds the little morsel of good. So whether it's, you know, trying to figure out what to do with COVID, open, close, wear a mask, don't wear a mask, stay home, go on vacation, I think try to find that little nugget today of what's good. I'm not going to do much about COVID today. Frankly, I'm kind of getting over it. And I may share a few things at the end about my patients and just how, you know, people are dealing with it. But I want to go into, I think I'm going to do some running things first. As most of you know, I've had some running setbacks after I did several back-to-back long races. I developed pain in my hip and into my groin and thought it was nerve-related, whether it was psoas or L4, L5. And the answer is probably yes. I've injured myself in the past. My nurse always tells my patients that, ask her about running injuries because she's had most of them, and it's true. But most of them come after overuse, so prolonged periods and race after race, or doing things, not taking a break, not doing appropriate stretching, strength training, a variety of things. You know, my muscles will revolt. And the sad part about it is it usually requires me taking a break of 4 to 8 weeks of different activity, lighter activity, and my muscles reset themselves and I'm able to resume my previous activities. And the question always comes, why? What happens? What's the breaking point? What can I do to make the breaking point come at a little later time, perhaps? I've been running since 2000, and I can tolerate more volume now than I could when I started. So certainly there's been an improvement in that. But the question always comes, what's causing the issue? It seems that I get overly tight, but yet I might be more mobile than I need. So it's that balance again that comes back to it. And this week I have come back around to doing more mobility, specifically where at hinge points and trigger release where tendons of big muscles, quadriceps and hamstrings and quadratus lumborum, all the big muscles of the back and the hips come in. And I've got miraculous relief from what seemed like sciatic pain or nerve pain just by freeing up my back because of my decreased hip mobility. Now, I didn't think my hip mobility was that bad. I'll point you, and I'm going to try to get him on the podcast, to Kelly Starrett. It's a PhD physical therapist that I've referred to in the past. But I was watching some of his mobility videos, and I thought I would go along and try, and didn't realize that I was doing some of the basic mobility / stretches. He hates the word stretch wrong or incorrectly or release. If you think about it, if you've ever done any foam roller or, you know, hard ball tissue release type of things, most people, you know, whether you're a strength athlete or any kind of athlete, endurance athlete, you typically get on that ball. If it's a piriformis release, people say sit on a tennis ball, and you sit on the tennis ball and you grit your teeth and you're hoping that the muscle relieves. Well, if you think about that, which I really didn't think about that too much until recently, if you're bearing down and you're gritting your teeth and trying to wait for your muscle, why in the world would your muscle ever release under that kind of stress? I've had podcasts with Patrick McGowan, and we've talked about sympathetic tone and parasympathetic tone, and that, you know, you have to go back into a parasympathetic calming relaxation to get decreased muscle contraction, and a more parasympathetic tone will allow, you know, more oxygenation to the tissues for healing. Yet when it came to doing these exercises, I was full on sympathetic tone, which, you know, drive contraction, drive my blood pressure, drive my heart rate, drive, you know, all kinds of counterproductive things. And no wonder they didn't work in the past for me. So that was part of it. And part of it, you know, knowing when to engage a particular muscle or relax a particular muscle. And so I learned some things this week as far as, you know, breathing and taking a breath in and holding it and relaxing and kind of allowing the muscle to release. And I actually had to spend some time trying to coordinate my breathing efforts. It was amazing how much I was actually just holding my breath while I was trying to do some of these release techniques. So, you know, I'd invite you to visit some of Kelly Starrett's mobility series on YouTube if you have a particular niggle that's going on. But I will say that as of today, I'm going to add, you know, I'm keeping these mobility things in, and I've identified, yes, I do, based on the proper technique of range of motion, that my hip range of motion was not as good as it should be, and that there's no reason for it not to be as good as a five-year-old. I may never get back to a five-year-old mobility, but there's no reason that if you could be mobile and steady at five, then why would you not want to be mobile at 57.9? So that's my new take on things. So yeah, a few weeks ago, if you listened to podcasts, it was like, okay, it's all about, I'm doing these planks and I'm doing the bird dogs, which I'm still doing to stabilize my back. But by releasing my hips, my back got a break. I could fire my glutes, and my glutes are what I wanted to fire anyway. And I couldn't figure out why my glutes wouldn't fire, but it was because my quadriceps were so tight and my hip flexors were so tight that I really was blocking out the contraction of muscles, which caused another problem. So if you're having any running injuries, you know, if your knee hurts, it's not necessarily your knee. It's usually above or below, and maybe both. Same way with shoulder. It's usually not just the joint. It is what's attaching. Same way with the foot. So look above, look below. And, you know, try not to jump to any, you know, strong conclusions. We like to, and again, we want it black and white. If my foot hurts, tell me what's wrong with my foot to make it go away now. Tell me what's wrong with my knee and make it go away now. Tell me what's wrong with my hip and make it go away down. And even as physicians, you know, there are many surgeries done on hip joints that really aren't the hip joint that's the problem, but all the musculature pulling on it that's probably causing a lot of the problems. So I'm back to running. Feel pretty good. I'm hoping that continues. I'm going to try to be more complete about both strength training and muscle activation and being a little bit more observant. So we have a little group going on, and it's gaining members both in Port Charlotte, Florida, and all around. You know, we'd like to welcome anybody to go on over to Facebook, Plant-Based Striders, and join in with us if you want to do an endurance activity. We're running, but if you're running or biking and you'd like to have a group to help you be accountable, we're doing that. And you don't have to be a member of my practice to participate in that. The idea is that we're going to take a group of people to the Treasure Coast Marathon in March. I'm not going to take them, but we're going to meet you there. We're going to run together and celebrate being plant-based and COVID-free and have a great time. So if you're interested in doing any of that, go on over to that marathon's March the 1st, so you have plenty of time to get from the couch to the marathon in some fashion. It's a small marathon, it's a great marathon for a beginner. And so we've been running in the mornings. And it's been good, but it's pretty humid down here in Florida. And, you know, I've heard people say this humidity is really tough. And it is. When you're running in high, hot, humid conditions, it does affect you. It's largely why they don't have many marathons in the summertime. I always laugh. They have Ironmans in the summertime because the water is warmer. But then, you know, you're running in the heat of the day for the most part. But when it's hot, your body, your capillaries dilate in your skin, and you sweat. and the sweat evaporates and you're cool. But if it's humid, that blanket of wet air around you doesn't allow the sweat to evaporate off your skin as much, so you don't cool as effectively. And if you add some sun onto that, it can be more difficult. If you add increased fat mass onto that, or even body mass in general, it can be more difficult because your heart has to pump to, you know, a larger blood volume, all those extra capillaries and that, you know, so more length to go to. So besides lightening your load, both clothing-wise and weight-wise, you need to slow down a little bit and allow your heart rate to come down and so that your body can cool itself appropriately. So most people are going to run slower in hot, humid conditions, and that's still good because we want your heart rate to be not in that anaerobic zone for most of your training run. We don't want you to be acidic. You lose more glycogen if you're running at higher heart rates, which means that you're not going to run as long, and your body will slow you down because if you have to burn fat, you have to burn it at a lower heart rate, so you got to slow down. And typically, if you're running hot, you're actually generating more heat that you have to evaporate, so it becomes a vicious cycle. So just be happy that you're out and moving and hopefully pain-free and slow down and enjoy the scenery and allow your heart rate. And you'll still get the training benefit. So if you ran, you know, a 9-minute pace at a heart rate of 130 at 50 degrees and now you're running a 10.5-minute pace at a heart rate of 130 at 85 degrees with 98% humidity, you're still going to get the training effect of that heart rate, and you're still going to get the benefits because your heart's putting out. You're actually training your capillaries, and you're training at that particular heart rate. But you're also not stressing your body to the point of becoming hot. And like I you know discussed a couple weeks ago with working out in the yard and actually having my core temperature go up for hours, if you're out doing a long endurance event, your heart rate, your temperature goes up regardless. Your core temperature goes up. So it's not unusual for people to finish, you know, a marathon with a temperature of 101, 100, you know, especially as it gets hotter. And of course, then there's heat exhaustion. You keep them going further. So you don't want to get your heart rate up too high because then your temperature is going to go up quicker as well. So slow it down, enjoy the time out there, and get your vitamin D and go on about it. People have asked me, what about salt when running and, you know, you're sweating a lot and don't you need to take in salt? Well, the most people get in plenty of salt during the day in the regular diet, even if it's a great plant-based diet. If you just ate fruits and vegetables, you're going to get 750 to 800 milligrams of salt in your day. Add to that condiments, and it doesn't take long to get up to that 1500 milligrams of salt. If you're having any processed food, you're likely going to go over that. So if you start adding salt, then you're going to get, you know, much more than your recommended amount for the day. So that's not so good. Salt helps you retain water, but it's also going to drive your blood pressure. When you sweat out some salt, but you sweat out more water than salt. And the reality of it is you sweat out more water from the breakdown of muscle glycogen than you do actually losing the volume from your blood volume. So if you think about, you have a hose full of water or blood, and you have a well, most of the water is coming from the well, not the actual pipeline, when you're sweating. So we don't get profoundly dehydrated until you've sweat quite a bit, and you're not going to lose a significant amount of sodium. They've never correlated muscle cramping with salt loss. Replacing electrolytes doesn't get rid of muscle cramping. Slowing, you know, people say, oh, yes, it does. Well, most of the time people, when they start cramping, they slow down, and that's what gets rid of muscle cramping. So you slow down, let your heart rate come down, let your muscles relax, you buffer your lactic acid, and then things start to relax. But most of the time, muscle cramping is just from muscle fatigue and slowing down and, you know, stretching, stopping. that's going to be the ultimate change in, you know, getting the muscle cramping to stop, but it's not taking in more salt. And the reality of it is, if you take in more salt and you're already, when you're doing an endurance athletic endeavor, you shunt blood flow to your skin to cool it and your muscles to contract. So you're shunting blood away from your GI system. So you already have blood shunted away from your GI system. Now, if you take in salt, you're just going to suck in water into your stomach. It's not really going to get into your blood system because you don't have that much blood going into, you know, your GI tract. So people end up getting bloated. So they have a bunch of water that's sloshing around their belly, and then they start getting belly cramps, and they don't get good flow to their belly, and that ends up stopping them. So you're better off, drink till you're thirsty. Drink before you go out to run. Drink when you're thirsty. Slow down, keep your heart rate down, and that's really the best way to handle running in the summer in the heat. What about insulin-resistant or diabetic runners? Well, again, you have more glucose in your bloodstream than you can get into your muscle or your liver because the cells are being blocked, or the uptake's being blocked by fat. So you have to produce more insulin from your pancreas. So you have higher insulin in your blood. You have higher glucose in your blood. The higher insulin produces chemicals like insulin-like growth factor and tumor necrosis factor and interleukin-6, but it also causes the release of adipose or fat tissues into the blood in the form of triglycerides. So now in your bloodstream, you have increased insulin, increased glucose, increased triglycerides, and these other factors, which tend to make your blood thicker. So now you've got to retain some water, or you're thirsty because you have all these extra things in your blood system, and then you pee a lot. So people that are diabetic can tend to be on the dehydrated side all the time. So before they go out in the heat, they're already somewhat dehydrated. The other problem is that you need to burn glucose and fat to make energy to make your muscles contract. And if you can't get the glucose in the cell, then you're burning what you have. And if you're running at a higher heart rate, you burn that glucose off, then you're going to have to stop. And it's harder to get at your fat stores if you're not getting good oxygen to your blood or into the blood vessels that go to your muscle cells. So you want to deliver oxygen to your muscle cells. And if you're breathing through your mouth and you're breathing off a lot of carbon dioxide, you're not going to deliver as much oxygen to your muscle cells, and you're not going to be able to burn fat. And so that can start to back up. So you end up wasting your glycogen stores, and then you hit the wall sooner. Again, we talked about increased inflammatory proteins in the blood with people that are insulin resistant or borderline diabetic. So you have a high insulin level, you have increased interleukin-6, interleukin-2, and you recover less quickly. You also have more vasoconstriction, and it doesn't, when you start to exercise, normally your blood vessels dilate in your skeletal muscle system, but it doesn't work as quickly in those people that are insulin resistant, so they actually can get some what we call paradoxical vasoconstriction. So when you start out, your blood vessels aren't dilated, you don't get the good blood flow to your legs, they're kind of crampy, they're tired. It takes a while before the blood vessels dilate, so it takes a longer time to warm up. Sometimes people don't warm up. That takes them a lot of exercise. They have to really keep at it before their blood vessels start to dilate. So, you know, the more you exercise as a diabetic, the better it gets. So, again, if you're a diabetic, you need to make sure you're well hydrated. You need to run at a lower heart rate. So I really would advise running with a heart rate monitor to keep your heart rate down, because we don't want you burning excessive glycogen because you don't have that much ability to take up glucose. And of course, we need to normalize your body mass index, get the fat out of the muscle, get the fat out of the liver to restore normal metabolism. In the meanwhile, we want to try to train people to breathe through their nose so that they can hold on to a little bit more carbon dioxide, deliver a little bit more oxygen to your tissues, so you're able to burn more fat than you would, which will help you get rid of the fat in the muscle and in the liver. So that is where it's at as far as diabetics. Interestingly, there was a journal article in Cell Reports Journal that looked at the genetic expression in endurance athletes versus strength athletes versus controls. We know that if you do long-term endurance athletics, cycling, bike riding, swimming, it increases the mitochondria in your muscle cells so that you're able to metabolize more glucose and fat. It increases the capillary density in the blood, in the muscle, so that you can deliver more blood to the muscles to deliver more oxygen and nutrients. Again, you're able to generate more fat, glucose, and energy. And the muscle cells themselves start to get bigger. Your insulin sensitivity improves when you exercise. So you're getting the fat out of the muscle cell to improve the uptake of glucose and glycogen. There's also a sense of well-being. People feel better, general better outlook on life. It's been shown that people that do endurance athletics and weight training increase your lifespan, your brain function, decrease your incidence of cardiovascular disease, decrease the incidence of diabetes, decrease muscle mass loss, decrease osteoporosis, and even decrease cancer. But how does that all work on a genetic level? So this report was very interesting. It looked at the genomes and the genes associated with some of these metabolic changes in the muscle and in energy production. And what they were looked at is a thing called transcriptome. And they were able to correlate, you know, what genes and how many genes were changed in endurance athletes versus strength athletes versus controls. And it was a small study, eight or nine people, and women and men in each group. And interestingly, the endurance athlete and the strength athlete, they had been long-time endurance athletes or strength training athletes greater than 15 years. And the controls were basically just, you know, normal people walking around. And what they were able to find was that people that were endurance athletes tended to have more genes turned on to improve metabolism and better muscle health than strength training. And that long-term endurance activities in both actually improved these things. And there are basically 10,000 genes expressed in human muscles, and there is difference between men and women, about 3,000 genes that are known to work differently in men and women. But what they were able to find out was that, you know, the oxygen consumption in endurance athletes was better, and the genes associated with this was better. The quadriceps strength in strength training athletes were better. Their ability to use mitochondria were a little bit better in the endurance athletes. But overall, there were 1,711 genes in women and 1,097 genes in men that were regulated, upregulated versus controls in the endurance athletes. And there were genes associated with cell respiration and metabolism. And it was much better in the endurance athletes than even the strength training athletes. But again, the protein and upregulation of muscle cell growth was good in both long-term athletes. So the bottom line is that they also looked at 6 months to 12 months of training, you could actually start to alter your genes, so that you improved all of these certain things. So no matter what age you are, you can actually turn genes on and turn genes off. And in this study, it was a positive, turning positive genes on associated with better metabolism, better muscle strength, better muscle fibers by exercising. So get out there and do it on a consistent basis. And only good things can happen. You know, like we've talked before, eating plant-based can turn off cancer genes and or down-regulate bad genes, and eating poorly can up-regulate good genes. Our genes are a deck of cards, but they have to be turned on some way. So we have to turn them on with some sort of activity or environmental asset or insult. So what we eat is can be an asset to our genetics, and what we do physically can be an asset to our genetics. So I thought that was a very interesting study. The other thing I want to look at is bread again. You know, I've been baking sourdough bread, and you know, I'm having a lot of fun. I've been posting some of my loaves. I'm starting to make some designs on them. It's all great. It tastes good. Sourdough starter has a lot of lactobacillus and good bacteria, and it's fermented and it's better digested. So the question is, what about diabetics? What about diabetics? You know, I talk to my diabetics and says, no, you can't eat bread. You know, don't eat so much bread, because typically diabetics want to eat bread in place of vegetables and fiber. They crave bread, mainly because they're craving carbohydrates, and bread is a great source of carbohydrates. But it turns out that in a lot of diabetics, they can't really uptake the glucose from the bread very quickly. It takes longer. So if a diabetic has a sandwich for lunch, their glucose may stay up higher than if they had a salad and beans for lunch. But it varies. It varies from person to person, and it varies in what they ate or what they eat. For instance, if somebody has bread and hummus, so hummus is beans ground up, so that makes them more dense and they tend to be higher calories and bread, then it's worse on somebody than they had, say, a salad and bread. And so I wanted to look at things a little bit. In the bread sourdough bread that I make, it has, if we look at the protein content of bread, there in 30 grams of bread flour, there's about 4 grams of protein. And that's roughly a slice. When I did the math on what's actually in my sourdough bread, the starter. And sourdough bread is flour and water. That's all there is, and the bacteria that comes in the flour and the yeast in the flour. So basically, if you were to have 2 slices of sourdough bread, that's 8 grams of protein or 220 calories. And so, you know, we talk about eat potatoes or beet grains. So what happens, when I tell my patients, it's kind of either or, because when you get the calorie-dense foods going, then that's when they tend to get in trouble being able to clear the glucose out of their system. So I decided, so what happens if, you know, my diabetics want to eat bread? So what do we do? Well, if you look at a baked potato, has about 110 calories and has 3 grams of protein. Interestingly, you know, when we talk about how much protein do you need, men need about 50, 55 grams of protein a day. Women need about 40, 45 grams of protein. A plant-based diet is about 10% of the calories in protein, which is perfect, is what you want. Most vegetables are 10% protein. And guess what? If you look at a baked potato, 110 calories and 3 grams of protein, that's 10% protein. So if you were to do, you know, a baked potato versus bread, you know, 1 baked potato, it's not as calorie dense or as dense in, you know, as 2 slices of bread. If you were to eat potatoes and bread, you know, you would think that would make things worse versus potatoes, worse maybe than bread than pasta or bread and beans. If you look at, if you were to eat a cup of greens, a cup of greens have 3 grams of protein, but only 34 calories. If you were to eat half a cup of pinto beans, that's 7 grams of protein for about 110 calories. So basically, a half a cup of pinto beans has the same amount of calories as a baked potato and one slice of bread. So what happens if we had someone have a cup of greens? And typically we want we're going to have them have 6 cups of greens, right, for nitric oxide production. So we have 6 cups of greens at 3 grams of protein. That's 18 grams of protein for the day. And we have them have half a cup of pinto beans at lunch and a half a cup at dinner for a whole cup. That'd be 220 calories. And then we have them have 2 slices of bread. And if you look at all that, that's 40 grams of protein for those 3 items. Not too bad. Not too shabby at all. So my point being is that you can get, you know, people talk about getting enough protein. Well, it's certainly there very easily. And so we don't have to worry about the getting, you know, our grains and our bread and our beans. So if you enjoy bread, first of all, you have to make sure of what kind of bread you're eating. Because now if you start getting bread that has a bunch of additives and, you know, shelf bread and all that kind of stuff, that's off the table. But if you're going to make bread with water and flour and salt and, you know, there's a little bit of salt in the bread to make it rise. So if you're doing flour and water and salt and either add yeast or you make a starter, then it's pretty much the same equivalent of eating, you know, your potato. But you have to watch the calorie density of everything together. So the calories started adding up a lot. So if you're eating a sandwich with hummus, you would be better off eating a sandwich with hummus. Or I'm sorry, you'd be better off eating a sandwich that's a veggie sandwich. Forget the beans. Or do a half cup of beans as opposed to the hummus, which would be more like the cup of beans. So all at once, because at a meal, you've got to process those. So you're going to eat and you're going to absorb that glucose and you're going to have a bump in your glucose, which is normal. We all do. And then it's got to settle down. But if you're doing this really calorie dense meal, then you don't get your glucose back down before the next meal. It clears your gut enough that you're hungry, and then you hit it again with another meal, and people never get their glucose back down to 100 between meals. So ideally, 2 hours after you eat, your glucose should be down to about normal again. But people with adult-onset diabetes, it may never get down. So you have to be really aware. If you want bread, we want you to have the greens as my take-home message. So I want 6 cups of greens a day in people. If you want to have bread with it, then okay, let's have the bread that is the flour and the water and the salt, but not, you know, nut butter or hummus on it. You're going to eat the bread. That's going to be your grain. You know, last night, my mom's a diabetic, and we had sourdough bread, and she actually had potato soup. And her glucose, she was fine. Her glucose actually didn't have a big bump. The potato soup was potatoes and leeks and peas and some peas, not a lot. And then the bread without anything on it. And we had a salad, so we had the greens with that. And she, you know, glucose was perfectly under good control, came right down. So when people have the big bump with bread, you have to start looking at the other calorie-dense foods that may be with it. So beans are probably a little bit more calorie-dense when you're starting to look at the bread. And so you just have to look and see what you can handle. I know some people have a little bit of difficulty with the oatmeal because, they can't handle that big, it's a big glucose rise that seems to last for a good bit. So those people might, you know, a little less oatmeal, a little bit more fruit. But certainly if you put toast bread with that oatmeal, then you'd have a really big rise. So you have to watch the caloric densities of the food as well as, you know, it's not really carb counting as much as is looking at the density of the meal. So if you're eating fruit and vegetables and you have some bread, it's not that big a problem. But if you're eating things that are other things that are ground that increase the density, calorie density of the meal, then you're going to have a bigger rise that may last longer. So that's a way to look at your glucose to see how you're going. The other thing that I was thinking about too is that, back in the day, bread's a pretty good thing to have if you're not going to have anything else for the rest of the day. You know, bread and water, that's how that made, you know, that's how people, how it lasted. So it does clear your system a little more slowly. And it's going to last for people that are, you know, if you're having just a salad and you don't want potato or grains, then having a piece of bread's not that big a deal. As long as you're not dipping it in oil or dipping it with nut butters and things. So That's my take-home message there on the bread part of things. And it's how the bread is made, and it's if you're sticking something on it that maybe you shouldn't. And you know, I was going to talk a little bit about, you know, the office and my older individuals and the stress that COVID has been, you know, playing on people. And I go back to just the take-home message is that we don't have control. I know I have some people that their kids are making them, you know, stay inside and don't go anywhere. And they're really worried. Their adult children are really worried about them. They're sending them pulse oximeters and masks that they have trouble wearing or breathing, and it gets in the way, or they can't hear. It messes with their hearing aids, or it causes them not to be able to function and potentially not see and be stressed because they can't hear people because they can't see their mouths. And the kids mean well. They don't want their parents to die. And you know, the people talk about, well, I don't want to infect my mom. I don't want to infect my aunt. You know, what do I do? But yet I'm not going to visit them. And I just have to say that, you know, there's so much we don't know about COVID and the transmission rate. Yes, it's transmitted by droplets and aerosols, and yes, it may be in the air, and it could linger depending on the temperature and the humidity, and there's so many variables. And there's so many variables in health in general. You know, I've been actively seeing patients every day since 1987 when I graduated from medical school. And if you think that you're so powerful that what you do is ultimately going to affect the life or death of someone, you're mistaken. Unless you're, actively taking their life. But, you know, an action such as, am I going to transmit a virus to somebody? Is it going to be my fault and I'm responsible? Let go of that guilt. Because life happens, and there are people that are exposed. You know, they grow up in a household of TB, and they don't get TB. They're exposed to COVID. Not everybody gets it, even if they're exposed. Not everybody dies if they get it. It's actually a pretty low mortality. But even if you're 90 years old, you have an 8% risk, 9% risk of dying every day of your life. So to blame yourself for a 90-year-old the day that they die coming is really not in your control. I've got to promise you that. So even, you know, I think people have to give themselves a break. You do the best that you can, but I think you look out for people's quality of life. And you have that open conversation with your loved one about their quality of life. Is sitting in a room for the last 3 out of the last 6 months out of your life, is that how you want to spend it? You know, because we don't know what tomorrow brings. We know that children have a low risk of death, but if they fall in the pool and drown, they don't. If that happens to be your child, it's a tragedy, and tragedies will always happen. And we don't know who tragedies will happen. They happen to good people. They happen to people that maybe you don't think are good people, but we don't have control over tragedies. So I think you look at, again, back at spending the, you know, look at every day and try to find something good about it. And you do the best that you can, and you live, and you let people live the best life that they want to live, and don't feel guilty over whatever happens. Because in the end, we don't have complete control, and we never will, whether you wear an N95 mask or you stay inside, or you get a vaccination. We're never going to have complete control. And so if you're always fighting for that, then you're always going to be frustrated and you're always going to be stressed. So do what you can. Be kind to others. Go outside. Take up running, cycling. If you take up cycling, wear a helmet. You know, enjoy being with others. And eat a plant-strong diet. Eat your vegetables. And if you're going to eat bread, make sure it's bread that's sour, that's flour and water and yeast or a starter. So have a good week. And I'm going to be speaking with a couple that just are completing a documentary on doing their first 50-mile run next week. Hopefully we'll get that up next week. But I will be talking to you next week. So have a good one. Enjoy it. Keep your heart rate down, but keep outside and keep going.